my life I've had hunches that something is going to happen, and they've come true. And I said to my friend next to me, I said, what a nice morning for a cushy blighty at home. Cushy being this, a real nice one, see. And I never remember another thing. I have no earthly idea what came down or how it came down, but I just had one stiffening bang. And I went like a poker. And when I came to, I noticed that my right foot had gone. I was hit behind the heel, which took the sole clean away. And the big toe was left dangling round and round and round, you see. So the Red Cross men, when they came, they just casually cut the toe away and threw it on the roadside.
So they were the words of a 19-year-old Scotsman called Horace Jock Gaffron, who was serving with the Gordon Highlanders on the Somme in 1916. He was wounded just 2 months after arriving on the Western Front. He'd hoped for a blighty. They all did, apparently. What was a blighty? It was a wound serious enough to enable you to be evacuated from the trenches and the battlefield back to Britain. But it wouldn't be life-changing. Perhaps to be shot in the arm or part of the leg. But poor old Jock, he got more than he bargained for, didn't he? His foot was hanging off. He had no control or influence over how he was going to be wounded or if he was going to be wounded or killed. It was completely indiscriminate with these awful trench mortars, heavy shells, light shells, machine gun bullets, rifle bullets. How could you control how or if you were going to be hurt? That only increased the fear when these men were in the front line or went into battle all those years ago during the Great War. So welcome to another episode of the podcast that I, Terry Wenham, called Tales from the Battlefields. And we're going to try and do something different this week, because this podcast is aimed at Year 10 and 11 students in comprehensive schools in the United Kingdom who are studying the Great War for their GCSEs that are fast approaching. Last week, I did a talk in a local school here in Northampton, Northampton Academy, a school that I take over to the battlefields every year. And the teacher, Mr. Rush, thought that it would be a good idea to turn the talk into a podcast that could then be distributed amongst not just the students of Northampton Academy, but throughout the country and maybe even further afield. So I hope that it will help those students with their studies, but I also hope it will be of interest to the regular listeners to the podcast as we delve further into what happened on the Western Front and how the medical process developed and evolved from the start of the war. And we're going to break it down into four sections, really. We're going to start by talking about the causes of the casualties and the nature of the wounds that those casualties encountered, like poor old Jock with his amputated foot. We're then going to talk about how those wounds, and not just the wounds, but illness, was treated as the war developed from 1914 right the way through to 1918. And as the treatment of those wounds evolved, so did the techniques. They improved, and some of those techniques and treatment that started in the Great War are still used today in modern life, not just in the United Kingdom, but throughout the world. So let's start by having a look at a breakdown of the battle trauma statistics that I discovered in an article published in the Western Front Association magazine, which they call Stand 2. And it tells us that the vast majority of casualties in the Great War were caused by shells and trench mortars and other missiles, 59%, well over half. And then 39% were caused by bullets from rifles and machine guns. And even with my basic ability in mathematics, that tells us that that constitutes, between shells and bullets, well over 90% of the casualties. Only 2% came from things like bayonets and gas. And when it came to where in the body people got wounded, nearly 40% of the wounds occurred in the feet and legs, and that's not entirely surprising, because I know I've heard that the Germans, for one, were trained to aim their machine gun bullets at the feet and the legs to stop the enemy from marching through no man's land towards them. 31% were in the hands and arms, 17% in the face, head or neck, 6.5% in the back, 4% in the chest, and just over 2% in the abdomen. Now, we're going to talk about all of these things today, but what we're going to try and do for those GCSE students is use some sources and hear from the men themselves that were wounded and how they coped with it and what they experienced. And when it comes to the process of evacuation, well, what a lot of people forget is that that process began with the soldier himself, because every man was provided with an emergency field dressing. They were basically cotton bandages and wads of cotton wool treated with a chemical was attached to the bandage. A safety pin was provided to make sure that the dressing could be put in place over the wound by the soldier, if he could, of course. And that helped in stopping the blood flow and blood loss and keeping the wound relatively clear until he could be treated by professionals. But quite often, the bandages, the dressings, would become infected. We're going to hear more about that later on. But it did have not just a practical purpose for the soldier, but also a psychological effect, because it reassured him that he was already being medically cared for to a certain extent, and that hopefully first aid was on the way. What type of wounds could a soldier expect to receive? Well, as we saw from those statistics, the vast majority of them would be from shrapnel, from the case of a shell, or from the shrapnel balls that are packed inside shells, or from horrific high explosive shells that cause multiple wounds. All of these shells did. The loss of limbs, mutilation injuries, and where dugouts and trenches had been blown in, soldiers could be crushed. Bullets would, of course, cause terrible wounds. Quite often, a neat wound on the way in, but as it exited the head, so many reports I've read of a massive wound at the back taking away the back of the skull. And in that situation, of course, it would be fatal. As the war developed, gas, as we've seen in previous episodes of the podcast, would be used by both sides. Chlorine gas caused effectively drowning from within. The lungs would fill up with liquid and the soldier would drown on his own blood, really. Mustard gas was introduced towards the end of the war. It wouldn't have an effect in so many cases immediately, but within a few hours, the soldier would begin to feel his skin burning both on the inside and outside of his body as the gas got into his uniform. Shell shock, something not encountered in previous conflicts, was to become a big issue in World War One. Men were to be suffering from shell shock into their old age. How could the human brain cope with being under fire from these terrible artillery guns for prolonged periods of time? It basically sent them mad in so many cases. And then when it came to illness, trench feet at the beginning of the war was a constant problem. Having men's feet submerged in muddy water for long periods of time effectively meant that the feet started to rot and sometimes toes fell off. And at the end of the war, that last year, the flu pandemic was brought over by soldiers from America. It killed more people than the war, and that had to be managed as well. So when it came to being evacuated from the Western Front, you applied your field dressing yourself, and then hopefully a stretcher bearer would arrive. Men from your own battalion or unit, perhaps you knew them, they would turn up and it would take up to 4 men to carry a wounded casualty out of the trenches. Let's hear from one of those stretcher bearers, shall we? This is 19-year-old Dick Barron. These are his words.
It's bloody awful. Have you ever carried a chap on a stretcher? I felt that my arms were coming out their sockets. It's a chap gets very heavy, you know, to carry him very far on a stretcher. I was only a youth, and I hadn't got all that strength. To carry a chap on a stretcher, you don't want to have to go very far with him. Especially when you've got across terrain where it's all bumpy and very difficult terrain. So work on a stretcher is very, very exhausting.
This next personal account comes from a stretcher bearer called Bill. And he describes the type of wounds that he came across whilst working as a stretcher bearer on the Western Front.
Most of them, they were chest or stomach wounds, and they were really serious. And that was awful to handle them. You know, you'd practically pick them up in pieces, but if they were still alive, you had to cart them away, and you know jolly well that they die at any time. The main thing was getting them out of it. And that's what we used to do.
If blood was coming with pulses, you know, you felt, you knew that he'd had it. And all you could do was to put a dressing on and either send him back or... But you felt you had to do something. You know what I mean? Even if it was only putting a dressing on it.
Must have been awful for Bill and his colleagues having to carry out such work. And he describes what happened when he got the casualty's blood on his hands.
I didn't like it. If you had to touch a man and you got it and that dried on your hands, that was a horrible feeling. They used to be sticky and awful. I used to hate it. Horrible feeling.
Going back to Dick Barron, who we heard from earlier, he describes the moment that he saw one of his pals killed and how he tried to do something from him, even though he knew it was hopeless.
He fell, and I looked at it, and I could see his brains. And I... Sounds gruesome, but all I could do is to put the brain, which had exuded through the wound, back into the cranium. You can't imagine to see your pal with it like that. You felt you've got to do something. And that's what I did. No good, of course, was it?
So a stretcher bearer's job was to take the casualty back, first of all, to a regimental aid post, which would be in a support or reserve trench. And here, a soldier's injuries could be triaged by a doctor. The wounds would be redressed and pain relief given. And then, if the soldier survived, he'd be taken back by stretcher bearers from the Royal Army Medical Corps to dressing stations. And then further back to field ambulance units, which ran advanced and main dressing stations. And here a soldier would receive further treatment. If you go to the Ypres area, a lot of these dressing stations were located along the canal bank at Essex Farm, famous, of course, for the poem In Flanders Fields with John McCrae, or on the other side of the canal. There's now a massive concentration cemetery called New Irish Farm, and this was the location of one of those dressing stations. one personal account describes the situation at Irish Farm. It says it lies near Boundary Road, about where Buff's Road joins it. And from all appearances, it is thoroughly searched by shells. Just across the road were some huge howitzers sulking under their camouflage. And beyond, in a fringe of stumps marking a former wood, was a low row of naval guns whose snouts we could see and whose flashes and roars were too close for comfort. The wounded straggle in, one of them with a bloody bandaged leg being helped along the narrow duckboards by two Boche prisoners, the sights which would be good for the hate on both sides. A narrow gauge train with its little gasoline engine pulls into the camp with some casualties from the forward area. A sopping Tommy rides by on a mule with his upper lip, nostrils and part of one ear blown off, but still worthy of salvage. Further on, a recently disemboweled horse lies at the side of the road, reddening the pools in the muddy water of the ditch for 100 feet beyond. Passing on is the dressing station at Duhallow. This is close to Bosingay and another location of one of the Commonwealth War Graves Commission cemeteries today. The quote says that the commanding officer has erected his tents on a sea of mud and shell holes which had to be filled in with whatever can be found. Indeed, more like the ancient lake dwellers in parts, for the canal has expanded into a veritable lake over which duckboards in many areas stand close together on piles. So reading that about the dressing stations, it's clear that the casualty is not out of danger. First of all, he's in danger from his wounds, but he's also in danger from incoming fire from enemy artillery. But the next stage in the evacuation process takes him to a casualty clearing station, and this is the first opportunity for major surgery to be carried out. These were semi-permanent medical facilities, and more than not, they were located next to railway lines, and this helped speed up the evacuation process. So what was the function of a CCS, as they were called? It was really the pivotal point in the whole system of evacuation. It was first created as early as 1907. They were intended as almost sorting centres to facilitate the movement of casualties from the dressing stations and the field ambulance to the base hospitals, which were usually based on the coast and well away from the battlefield. Their role was to act as a temporary reception area for the sick and wounded and arrange for the patients to be satisfactorily evacuated to the next stage at those base hospitals. Some of these casualty clearing stations were enormous, like the one we're going to talk about in a minute near Poppering at Remy Siding. As their role evolved, it became similar to a modern-day accident and emergency department. Casualties were received, assessed, and then divided into three categories, and that's what today we call triage. Those categories were non-serious cases, those soldiers that could be returned to duty after recuperation and rest, serious cases but still fit to travel, and those are the ones that were going to be evacuated back to the base hospitals, and serious cases in urgent need of immediate treatment. Those casualties were then provided with food and rest, and they were prepared for their further journey, and that could be immediately put onto an ambulance train or after an operation or further period of recuperation. But sometimes soldiers could spend up to 4 weeks in a casualty clearing station before moving on. Now, in 1914 and 1915 was when the casualty clearing stations were first mobilised over in France and Belgium. They soon found that they got a high volume of cases coming from the early battles on the Western Front, and so many of these wounded were suffering from gangrene or abdominal injuries. And so many of these abdominal injuries would result in death, and gas gangrene in a human being was also a terrible thing to have. It was the scourge of military hospitals, and it was carried from wound to wound by unknowing doctors and nurses, and it quite often was transferred therefore within these medical units. It was effectively poison that was absorbed into the bloodstream, and it would cause organic disturbances, fever and degeneration of the tissue. Invasion of the blood was not uncommon, and in fatal cases, death came sometimes within a day of the soldier being infected. But perhaps the most common way of getting gas gangrene was when you were shot or you received a piece of shrapnel into your body. It would take with it part of your uniform, the cloth, the khaki cloth, khaki green. And with it, it would bring germs. And now we can listen to the words of a nurse that was trying to treat a soldier that had been infected with gas gangrene. These are her words.
They came in with terribly septic, deep, gangrenous wounds. And one of my vivid recollections when I was on the military ward was a man with a gaping wound about 14 inches long, right down to the bones of his lower leg, and I should think about 2 inches deep. And in the depth of that wound, there was patches of gangrene. And they found that by introducing maggots into the wound, the maggots ate the gangrene, and then they could start to heal the leg up. That was a shock to me, to see, first of all, these nasty little things crawling about in the man's leg. They didn't come loose in the bed. It was exposed, you see, and they were having their feed.
And at first, these casualty clearing stations were quite away from the front line, but surgeons argued that they could save many more lives if the units were within 10,000 yards of the front line. And although there was danger to that, of course, it was decided that that was going to happen. And as I said earlier, these CCSs were placed beside railheads, and it meant they became really static rather than moving around. They were more like hospitals. By 1917, more and more operations were being performed at these casualty clearing stations. What I'm going to do now is explain about what would happen when a patient arrived at a CCS. There would be a stretcher exchange dump where the drivers of motor ambulances delivered casualties and exchanged the equivalent of equipment that was handed in. There was then a general admission, a tent or a hut, and that's where a patient's particulars were recorded in the admission and discharge book, and his medical condition was classified by a medical officer. This is where this triage is happening. And this is where they were given refreshments, if possible, tea, coffee, hot soup, sandwiches and cigarettes. It's incredible now, isn't it, to think that cigarette might actually help a soldier. And then a patient might then go to a section for the dressing of walking wounded. Sit on a bench until he was attended to by a sister or an orderly that was working under a medical officer. There was then a section for the dressing of lying down patients. Stretcher cases were carried here. If the patient's wound was slight, it would be dressed and the patient was then taken to the evacuation ward. And if his wounds were more serious, he was passed on to the pre-operation ward. And in that pre-operation section, the patient's clothes were cut away and he was cleansed and made warm and fed again. But then there were those casualties that were too serious for an operation, a resuscitation ward. If the patient was too unstable for surgery, he was taken to this ward, and there a medical officer or sister or orderlies. He was rested, tried to keep warm, and maybe, as we're going to see later, given a blood transfusion. And also, this is where there could be an X-ray carried out. There were various mobile X-ray units serving in the British Expeditionary Force during the Great War, and these were sent to the casualty clearing stations during the Great Battles. And then there would be the operating theatre itself. After 1916, there could be one or two operating theatres accommodating up to 12 tables arranged in pairs, each pair being divided from the other to provide privacy for the patient. Two tables were often provided for each team in order to save time, and surgical teams worked in groups for up between 3 and 8 hour shifts with just 4 hours off to sleep. And this pattern meant that two operating tables could run continuously for a whole week. That was the theory, but of course, during major battles like Third Ypres and Messines, the casualty clearing station at Remy Siding, there was a Major Richard Clark, and he said during one offensive, the surgeons were to do 16-hour shifts with 8 hours off, thus giving us four tables going day and night. After the operation, the patient could be moved to the evacuation section, where we were waited to go back by the ambulance train to a base hospital. And then there was a retention ward. If the patient was too ill to be evacuated, he was taken to this ward. And this was situated at the back of the CCS in a quiet place. And there he was attended to by nurses and medical officers. And surgeon, Major Richard Clark of the Royal Army Medical Corps, we can read now a personal account of how a CCS procedure worked. He said the commanding officer was to be responsible for the administration and evacuation, and I was responsible for every case until operated on or marked for immediate evacuation. In the theatre, we had six tables, and the anaesthetist started the next case while the surgeon was dressing the last. Each surgeon had a sister and one trained orderly, and there was a free NCO, a non-commissioned officer, and a free sister in the theatre to do sterilising of instruments. When it is realised that by this system no surgeon saw the case he was to operate on until he was under anaesthetic, the proper selection of cases was of the utmost importance, and that is why we arranged that one man, myself, should stand the racket of any mistake. For this purpose, in the dressing room, I had 12 tables to fit stretchers and 12 orderlies, one to each table, and a most efficient corporal in charge. Every case was brought in, put on the table, his wounds undone, and a decision made by me as to his disposal, either to the resuscitation ward, to the pre-operation ward, to a ward especially kept for the dying, straight to one of the surgical wards, or for immediate evacuation. My problem in a battle was to keep all the surgeons busy with cases really urgently needing operation. At the same time, I had not to send so many to the pre-operating room that the last case would have to wait longer for his operation than if he was sent to the base, and above all, not to send cases in for operations so badly wounded as to be unlikely to recover. It was a fairly difficult business, but by being kept informed of train times, by interviewing ambulance drivers and finding if more were to come, and being in and out of the pre-operation room and theatre, I was able to get a fair idea of the position. What a dreadful role that man had got, really. He's really making a decision in so many cases between life and death, but by making those decisions, he's actually saving so many soldiers. Now, one of these casualty clearing stations was based, as I mentioned earlier, at a place called Remy Sidings. Now, this is near Poppering. And if anybody's listening to this that's organising a school tour to Ypres, then I really do strongly recommend that you stop the coach as you're entering the Ypres salient at Lishenhook Cemetery, Commonwealth War Graves Commission Cemetery. Just as you approach Poppering, you'll see a sign on the right-hand side, and then you turn right again. You soon come to the cemetery. There's a large car park there, where several coaches at any one time can be parked. There's toilets, there's often a couple of cats that will come and see you as well. And there's a visitor centre which explains the role of these vast casualty clearing stations that were here during the Great War. And this place was originally a farm that was taken over by originally the French army because it was close to the railway line and out of range of the German artillery. And between 1916 and 1918, there were four big casualty clearing stations that were here, and they covered an incredible 125 acres. and at one stage there were 4,000 beds here. Now, there must have been hundreds of thousands of soldiers that went through this casualty clearing station, and just under 11,000 of them died here, and they're buried in the Lichtenhoek Military Cemetery. And there are so many stories to tell that one day I'm going to do an entire podcast about the casualties there, but that's not what we're about this week. We want to tell the story of the casualty clearing stations itself. It was in August 1916 that the Canadian medics arrived and they took over the unit from the French. And there was a complex of huts and tents that were now extended considerably. And at one stage, there were 1, 2, 3, 4 casualty clearing stations here, and they contained an incredible 4,000 hospital beds. And they turned this place into a real village. There were streets that were built, flowers planted, there was an electricity generation unit and a water purification plant that was installed to have clean water, of course, was going to be so important. Staff started growing vegetables, they had concerts and the odd football match was organised in an attempt to make life more bearable. One man wrote in his diary, "I went for a walk in the afternoon. I saw the English hospital. What wonderful tents, big and numerous, built on a site full of flowers, nice turf and lovely little trees. There's an army of medical orderlies and nurses about." Now, these particular CCSs at Poppering became extremely busy during the summer of 1917, especially during the Battle of Messines. And on the 7th, 8th and 9th of June, nearly 5,000 casualties arrived, but only 600 of them died, and they're buried in the Lichtenhoek Cemetery there. And by my maths, that tells me that well over 4,000 of them survived and moved on to the next stage in the evacuation process at the base hospital. After the war, Lichtenhoek became a stationary hospital and they still had 400 beds there. Of course, at this time, we've now got problems with the flu pandemic. There were 35 members of the Chinese Labour Corps that died because of flu and they're buried there. And the last man to die at Lichtenhoek was on the 18th of June 1921, when a man called Meldrum died of a brain hemorrhage. But the story of Lichtenhoek is really about those that survived rather than those that died. And that's why I do encourage you to please go and see the exhibition there. And as part of the GCSE studies, you can take so much information away from there to use in your studies and examinations. So the next stage in the evacuation process would take the casualty to a base hospital, usually in places up on the coast, ready for evacuation back to the UK. It also benefit, of course, from the sea air, the soldiers that were being treated there. And here the soldiers would get further treatment, or perhaps they'd remain in hospital for more time to recover from their injuries, perhaps before being transferred back to their units on the Western Front. But let's go back, shall we, and talk to our Scottish soldier, Horace Jack Gaffron. If we remember the last we heard of him, he'd had part of his foot amputated by the side of the road that had saved his life. He's now reached a base hospital. And the next stage in his treatment is about to begin, but it's a horrific and traumatic situation that was going to affect him for the rest of his living days.
And the doctors had a look at me and I said that I did not want to lose my leg, my foot, if possible. But he said, "We will do what we can," but it was hopeless. The foot had to go and that was that. They put me on a table with a mattress. I think it was in the kitchen that they did it. And at last, they said I had the chloroform in those days. And it was done. They amputated my foot through the ankle. And I can assure you, that was no easy job. And it was extremely painful. I can assure you, if I ever howled in my life when I came out, I howled then. I made no bones about it. I really cried my eyes out when I saw the result. At my age, to have that injury was quite a shock. It meant that you would have to adapt your life in many ways. And that's just what I had to do.
Now, one of the most well-known diseases, if you can call it that, from the First World War was shell shock. We call it today post-traumatic stress disorder. And it was unheard of, really, before the Great War. But tens of thousands of men suffered from this, many of which never got over it. And we do need to look at this as part of the GCSE studies, what it was like to suffer from shell shock, how the nurses saw it. We can also look at some of the possible cures for it. But let's start by listening to Clifford Lane, who'd been serving with the Hertfordshire Regiment.
Every time I went over the top, I was just like, almost every time, somebody went insane. Only one person probably, you know, but I can see them now coming along singing. You know, they're absolutely lost their control of everything. I can remember one man come along with two men, one either side, holding his arms, singing under the old apple tree. He was letting it out, blaring it out, top of his voice. And almost every time I've seen men taken out of the line, but not, there weren't many, but people being dazed, lying on a parapet or on a fire step, you know, after a bombardment, dazed, that was quite common.
Archie Richardson had spent 2 months fighting in a tank during the Battle of the Somme, and clearly he was feeling the effects of it, as you can explain here.
I was shell-shocked at that time. Oh, yes, there was no doubt about that, I was shell-shocked. I wasn't in my right senses or anything else, you know. Makes you feel cringy, and it makes you feel, I don't know, it makes you feel bad in yourself, real bad. You begin to do like this, and I never did that before. But every time a big shell crashed, the tremendous corrupt noise they make, oh, like a crashing, like, well, I don't know what. A terrible crash, because they were dropping near, see? And every time one dropped, I quenched up like this. Well, I never did that before. So that shows I was shocked. And I couldn't believe myself at the time. I couldn't believe it. That I thought my nerves would carry me, but no. It broke my nerve.
And then, of course, it was down to the nurses in the hospitals and the casualty clearance stations and back home in Blighty to try and help the soldiers cope with this dreadful incapacity that they'd experienced. It really did prevent them from carrying out any day-to-day tasks. This nurse was called Mary Jolly, and she was from Edinburgh, and she can explain to us what she witnessed.
Well, the appearance of the men was very terrible to see, because they were trembling, facial trembling, and hands trembling, and they just couldn't control themselves, although they tried hard to control, because they probably knew that they were upsetting the person who was treating them. But it was very terrible to see. And they had tremors, hands and face, saliva even. There was one soldier, and he was so afraid of going to sleep
because of the nightmares that she had. And it, of course, it wasn't my business to go into that. That was the medical officer's business. But I couldn't help trying to ease the situation. And I said, what did you see? And he said, well, I saw wounded men on the ground. Our tanks coming along and just mowing through the wounded men. He said it was very terrible. But that was one of the worst ones. Hurt me very much. Hurts me now. Could be dripping with saliva.
So how was shell shock treated in these early days? The purpose of the treatment was to restore as many men as they could back to duty as quickly as possible. Every man was needed, especially in 1917 and 1918. And it's said that up to 80% of the men who'd entered hospital suffering from shell shock were never able to go back to military duty. The doctors came up with various treatments, involved massage, rest, dietary regimes, and even, incredibly, electric shock treatment. They'd try hypnosis, occupational training, and as one medical superintendent at a hospital in York put it, although the medical officer must show sympathy, the patient must be induced to face his illness in a manly way. It wasn't the sympathy offered to sufferers in those days. These days, help would be available from the army, and cognitive behaviour therapy, CBT, would be offered. Doesn't always work, but no longer do we consider these men to be weak. It's said that when shell-shocked soldiers returned home, things were not much better for them. There was a large hospital near Southampton called Netley, and there soldiers were greeted with silence. And soldiers were seen to be hanging their heads in inexplicable shame. And it was Siegfried Sassoon in October 1917. He was suffering from shell shock and being treated at the hospital Craig Lockhart in Edinburgh. And he wrote his famous poem called Survivors.
No doubt they'll soon get well. The shock and strain have caused their stammering, disconnected talk. Of course they're longing to go out again. These boys with old, scared faces learning to walk. They'll soon forget their haunted nights, their cowed subjection to the ghosts of friends who died. Their dreams that drip with murder. And they'll be proud of glorious war that shattered all their pride. Men who went out to battle, grim and glad. Children with eyes that hate you, broken and mad.
Now we can look at more positive things, really, and some of the great inventions that we still use today. And the first one I wanted to look at is the use of X-rays. This was a new technique that had been devised in the 19th century by a German, ironically, called Wilhelm Röntgen. He was a German scientist, and he was studying the effects of passing an electrical current through a glass tube covered in black paper. And he noticed that although everything in the room was dark, a screen about a metre from the equipment had begun to glow. He did some further experiments and he realised these rays could penetrate many objects. He placed photographic paper between the tube and his hand and he created the world's first X-ray image. And this was to be of great use to the surgeons during the Great War because although they could see from the outside if a soldier had been wounded or damaged by a bullet or shellfire, they couldn't see, in case of a bullet in particular, how it was affecting the body. They could only do that by looking inside. And it was to be x-rays that would enable them to do that and therefore determine what treatment the soldier needed. But of course, x-ray machines were in short supply during this early stage of its development. So what the Royal Army Medical Corps did, they realised that they had to get the equipment as close to the front line as possible. So they produced and manufactured portable x-ray equipment. These machines were also fitted onto hospital ships, which meant the casualty could be x-rayed whilst being transferred back to the United Kingdom. There's no doubt that the introduction of x-rays in the Great War saved many lives, but of course there was always consequences to anything. They didn't realise that working with x-ray equipment produced radiation poison and could result in people dying from cancer. And compensation was given to workers after the war who'd suffered the effects of working with radiation. One example of that is a man called Harry Henry. He'd worked as a radiographer at Queen Alexandra's military hospital from 1900, and he had obviously an increased workload during the war, and by 1919 he was suffering from radiation poisoning, and he was awarded money from a compassionate fund that had been set up. And then there was blood transfusion. At the start of the First World War, the technology for this was largely untested and not really accepted by the medical profession. But it really did improve the condition of many badly wounded soldiers, especially those that had got abdominal wounds. By 1915, it was accepted that abdominal wounds needed surgery as soon as possible. They really needed to be treated within an hour or two of wounding, otherwise they would hemorrhage or perhaps get sepsis and then die. Now, these early blood transfusions were direct from donor to patient. They'd use a tube to carry blood from an artery in the donor to a vein in the patient. This carried the risk that the blood would clot and block the tubes. So they came up with new techniques that were advanced during the course of the war. What they discovered was, and I quote, "In the cases of severe primary hemorrhage accompanied by shock, blood transfusion frequently produces an immediate and almost incredible improvement. The change from a pallid, sometimes semi-conscious patient with a rapid flickering pulse to a comparatively healthy-looking, conscious and comfortable patient with a slower and fuller pulse is dramatic evidence of the value of the transfused blood." As the war went on, the Royal Army Medical Corps declared that the use of blood transfusion was the most important medical advance of the Great War. And we've got some examples now of what happened when this technique was used to save men's lives. There was a Canadian surgeon called Lawrence Bruce Robertson, and he transfused fresh blood from lightly wounded donors. And in this case, he was treating an officer. On the 29th of July 1917 at St Bartholomew's Hospital in London, the soldier had got a penetrating wound of his chest. Robertson said that blood transfusion contributed to the survival of many cases. He says, for example, Second Lieutenant AJD admitted July the 29th, 1917, under care of Major G.E. Gask, in a collapsed condition, severe penetrating wound of chest, from which there had been a large amount of bleeding. Condition inoperable. Blood transfusion carried out. After 100 cc had been injected, operation was begun. Removal of shell fragments, irrigation of pleury cavity, closure of chest wall, further progress good, evacuated to base 9 days later in good condition. There was a Major Gordon Taylor, and he was the acting consulting surgeon to the British 4th Army, and towards the end of the war in September 19 he wrote this: "Several months' experience in the casualty clearing zone behind the Australian Corps has enabled me to form an estimate of the excellent work of the resuscitation teams of that corps. There can be no room for doubt that very many lives have been saved by the work of Major Holmes and the members of other resuscitation teams. Their experience in the dressing stations coincides with that of the casualty clearing hospitals. That in blood transfusion we have the most remarkable and valuable means of treating cases of severe shock and hemorrhage. Their results conclusively prove the value of these methods of resuscitation in the field ambulances." after the war. He carried out a study and he looked at 60 shock patients that were treated by this unit. And of the 60, 11 or 18% of them died. And the remaining 49 men were passed on from the unit in good condition. He gave an example of a soldier that had been treated. He said, general condition, extreme shock and severe hemorrhage. Both legs shattered below knee. Treatment, blood transfusion, condition improved, pulse now palpable. 136 per minute, very thready. Blood pressure, 80 mm. Operation, 1.5 hours. Later, under anaesthetic. The left leg was amputated at the junction of the upper and middle third. The right leg was placed on splint. We'll come to that later. Conditions now became very critical. Blood transfusion. Result, 1 hour later, the condition showed improvement. The pulse rate was 114 and the blood pressure 98. 36 hours later, progressing well. In July 1917, Lieutenant Cyril Edwards had his foot blown off. He'd suffered such severe bleeding from his wound that when he arrived at the frontline hospital, his heart had almost stopped. In charge of the hospital was a surgeon called Arthur Short, and he was a doctor that was interested in the early experimental blood transfusions that had been conducted at base hospitals, and he realised he needed to improvise very quickly. So he selected a donor, he brought him in alongside Edwards, and he cut into both men's arms, transferring the blood using a tube and needles. Rendall was to write later, "It is one's principal joy in life, almost, to see patients one cares about get better." Then there was another tremendous invention called the Thomas splint, which had been introduced in 1916. And this had a tremendous success in reducing mortality from fractures of the leg from 80% in 1916 to just 20% in 1918. The original instructions said that the Thomas splint should be used in three situations for all fractures of the thigh bone, except where there is an extensive wound in the upper part of the thigh or buttock, which would interfere with the fitting of the ring that surrounded the splint. Number two, in severe fractures about the knee joint or upper part of the tibia. Number three, in certain cases of extensive wounds of the fleshy part of the thigh. Now, every regimental aid post had a supply of approximately 10 of these splints. The device could be applied in no man's land by stretcher bearers before the victim was evacuated to a casualty clearing station. The fracture was immobilised effectively with less blood being lost. The majority of patients reached the casualty clearing station in good clinical condition and fit to undergo operations to save their limb and life. There were 1,009 fractures of the femur during the Battle of Arras in April and May 1917, with a mortality rate of 15.6% and an amputation rate of 17.2%. The significant reduction in mortality is directly attributable to the prevention of surgical shock by using this very effective splint. And in terms of an example, well, a great one is a man called George Henry Prentice, whose file is in the National Archives. He was in the trenches at Beaumont Hamel on the Somme when a shell landed outside of his parapet and it blew him against the wall and knocked him unconscious. What he didn't realise was that his left femur was fractured. And there's a record in his file, and it's dated the 13th of November 1916. For those of you that know about the Somme, they'll know that this was the second attack on Beaumont Hamel when the second mine was blown beneath the Hawthorne Ridge. And it says that Prentice was in the trenches and a shell landed outside the parapet, blew him against the parados, that's the back of the trench. He was in hospital about 5 months, his leg being in splints for 3.5 months during that period he was in hospital. Later on in the file, it tells us that he was walking with a slight limp after his treatment. And it also tells us that he was returned to active service. Now, throughout this podcast, we've been listening to the Scotsman, Jock Gaffron. And we're going to finish his story now. We're going to finish the podcast by explaining what happened to him, because he now finds himself back in the UK with his so-called blighty wound, having had his foot amputated, and he's in a hospital in York. But what happened there? Do you remember gas gangrene?
When I heard them mention gangrene, I was terrified. They took my leg off from the ankle to 4-6 inches below the knee. And that was a big one. And I can assure it was sore, very sore. And I felt it. And I, once again, I did a hell of a lot of crying. Good, hefty stuff. Dressing time was an ordeal at all times. I dreaded this because the bandages that I had on had dried and they had to be pulled away. And much of the dressing adhered to the skin.
Jock's stay in hospital was made bearable only through the friendship he made with a volunteer nurse, known simply to him as Nurse Sutherland.
She was my nurse, and she certainly looked after me in every way. It wasn't a case of attraction, like, it was a case she was good at her job. Very good at her job. She never spoke hardly except words of comfort, and I did nothing else but cry. And being a soldier and being 20 or 21, I didn't want to be more or less a child and cry down. But cry I did, and plenty of it.
Earlier in the podcast, we heard from the stretcher bearer, Dick Barron, and he was one of those that became very ill because of the conditions in the trenches and on the battlefield. He got dysentery, and it made him want to die.
And one morning I found I couldn't stand, and I had to be a casualty. I was dangerously ill. I thought and I hoped I was going to die, and the medical officer, I'm sure, never thought I would recover. And I can tell you truly, there was a state where I just wanted to give in. You know, it would have been, you know, quite pleasant. Give up the struggle. That's it. I can't describe it more than that. That it would, the death had no fear for me.
And going back to the man that we featured all the way through the podcast, Jock Gaffron, he tells us that he kept in touch with that nurse that looked after him, Nurse Sutherland.
She wrote, and she was retiring, sort of. I don't know what happened. So I wrote her, and I said I'd come down with my friend, we'd call in and see her. But about a week before we were due to leave, I had a letter saying that she had died. I don't know the cause or anything, but she evidently died. I missed her a lot.
He has quite a distinctive voice, doesn't he, does Jock? And I was going to leave the podcast there and wrap it up with some thoughts about how casualties were treated on the Western Front, how the process evolved over the 4 years. But I can't leave it there, because I don't know about you, during the last hour or so, I've listened so much to Jock's voice. I feel as though I've got to know him. So I wanted to find out what happened to him after the war. And it comes as no surprise to discover that he lived a very full, colourful and long life. I have in front of me his obituary that was written in April of the year 2000, 103 years after he'd been born in Aberdeen. The obituary tells us that he was the son of an Aberdeen tailor. His family were very talented through different generations, producing clocks, photographers and draftsmen. The article then goes on to tell us about what happened to him during the war when he had his leg amputated. And we also discover the actual location of where he was wounded, and it was in what's known as Death Valley, which in August of 1916 was behind the lines. And it's the valley in front of Mametz Wood that had been attacked and eventually taken by the Welsh in July of 1916. That's where a shell came over and took out half his company and seriously wounded Jock. But believe me, that wasn't going to define him. Not a man of this nature, of this determination. A newspaper once asked him what he thought on Armistice Day in 1918. He says, "Oh, nothing much. My thoughts will go back to France and the morning I was wounded. I was scared like the rest of them," he said. Now, remember, he was just 19 when this happened, and he was sent back to Aberdeen to convalesce. And there we discover that he had the good fortune to meet a lady called Rachel, who was from Edinburgh. And she gave him the stability that he needed in 1921. They got married. And then they moved down to London, where Horace was able to develop his gift for drawing. He'd even sent various drawings back from France to the Aberdeen local newspapers during the war, sketches of the Western Front. And he found himself becoming very successful at drawing and became a commercial artist in 1928. And that took him across the Atlantic to America. And he had the confidence to confront New York and Chicago publishers. He lived in the States for 3 years, regularly working for well-known magazines such as Good Housekeeping. He continued to visit the States even after he came home, but his base was always going to be London. He then became the European art director for an American advertising agency, and that work took him to places like Paris, Stockholm and Copenhagen. And he worked right into his 80s. The obituary tells us, for all his energy and business acumen, his particular forte lay in tender, humorous drawings of children, whom he had a lifelong empathy with. The couple had one son called Bruce. His busy life allowed hobbies. He was a keen drummer, a lover of jazz, and he was a lover of rodeos. He was a rope spinner, and he performed in concerts aboard the Queen Mary, and I've even found a photograph of him doing that, along with several other incredible photographs, which I'll put on the podcast page of my website, terrystours.co.uk. On post-war children's television, he appeared as a cartoonist on various programmes. He swam, he cycled. And then in 1977, after 56 years of marriage, his life changed drastically when his dear wife Rachel died. His son, Bruce, was long established in California, and Horace lived alone in his Wimbledon home until 1989, when he made the decision to enter a care home in Scotland that was run by the charity Blesma. He'd never forgotten his roots or lost his Aberdeen tongue, and he says that living at the Blesma home added several years to his life because he benefited greatly from the care and company in that home. Age mellowed him. I think he was quite a firebrand in his youth. In his last year, he grew steadily more frail. But he well knew the harsh realities of life, of course, and he wasn't afraid of death. It was his brother-in-law that wrote this obituary. And he said, ever a child at heart, he possessed a childlike trust in a divine providence. He'd known all the highs and lows of human experience. And though never one inclined to bouts of seriousness, he believed that somehow, somewhere, all made sense and on balance was good. He lived across three centuries, but it was the quality of the man that most commanded admiration. He possessed numerous qualities, many contradictory. He was a man of deep feeling, yet a natural extrovert, warm-hearted but principled, and he hated being called a hero. He rejected that description, but a man of great resilience. No one who met Horace, as he was officially called, was unaffected by him. He made his mark, and he meant to do so. His characteristic response to the question, "How are you today, Jock?" was, "I'm well and wicked." He loved meeting people and he relished conversation. He was never short of an answer. He had true grit and it showed throughout his life. The writer says that Jock was a great guy, an exceptional man, a friend and an inspiration to many over the years. And I would like to think, as we've followed the story of Jock from 1916, when he was wounded right to the end of his life, that it's going to be an inspiration to everybody that listens to this podcast. As we think about all of the sufferings that these men experienced after they were wounded, but how they benefited, like Jock did, from technology, from the medical process being developed and evolved by scientists and medics. Very quickly, from 1914, he no doubt is grateful for those advances in medical science, and so are we, because it gives us the opportunity to see what this man was like, to listen to his voice, and as we go about our daily lives, to be thankful for the sacrifices that people like Jock gave up, as we've said many times on this podcast, so that we can live the life that we do now. When asked why he'd lived so long, he said he'd worked hard in his life and he'd enjoyed his life and his work. And he said, with a twinkle in his eye, "The other secret is I've been a teetotaler and non-smoker all my life." But before he reached the century mark, he was asked what was his ambition. He said that when I die, I want to be shot in bed by a jealous husband. Thank you very much for tuning in once again to the podcast Tales from the Battlefield. Hopefully we've reached a new audience this week by helping Year 11 students with their GCSE studies. There's plenty of new sources for information that we've included here today. And of course, we realise that those Year 11 students will be the next generation, hopefully, of World War I enthusiasts and maybe battlefield guides and even podcasters as their life goes forward. And we hope one day to see them out on the battlefields. Now, we'd normally, at the end of the podcast, play the last post, but I'm not going to do that this week. I think we owe it to all of these men who were survivors, not victims, to play something else instead. I don't know about you, but I can just imagine men like Jock singing along to this song.
Who was it pinched the barber's pole and used for fuel to save the coal?
Mademoiselle from Arles.